There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about President Trump's legal issues. My co-host is Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. He also blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So this was another big week. Ambassador Bill Taylor testified on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. This is the career diplomat whom Secretary of State Mike Pompeo sent to Ukraine to replace Marie Yovanovitch, the ambassador whom President Trump ordered recalled. And Taylor described a quid pro quo. He said that EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland told the Ukrainians that release of U.S. military aid, which had already been appropriated by Congress, was going to be dependent on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky making a public statement pledging an investigation into Burisma, the company where Hunter Biden had sat on the board. Taylor then spoke with Sondland. He had learned about Sondland's statement to the Ukrainians from an official on the National Security Council. And Sondland told Taylor that he'd made a mistake earlier when he'd suggested that only a White House meeting was dependent on Ukrainian compliance with the president's wishes about Joe Biden investigations. In fact, quote, everything depended on that. Sondland also offered an explanation to Taylor that the president is a businessman and that when he is owed something from someone, he wants the payment before he's going to give them the thing that they're expecting in return. So, Ken, that all sounds pretty damaging and pretty clearly a quid pro quo.
Very much so. It's extremely incriminating to Sondland and to President Trump and the administration. It very much contradicts the message that's been out there that there was no quid pro quo. And it puts into context some of the text exchanges we have between these two men. Most notably, you might remember there was this infamous exchange where Taylor said to Sondland, are we really doing this? This is ridiculous. And Sondland said, let's talk later. And later he comes back, apparently after having talked to Trump, with a very self-protective text saying, well, the president told me there's no quid pro quo, laying a record, basically. But what Taylor told Congress in this hearing, apparently, is that after that exchange, he talked to Sondland, and Sondland said, well, there's no quid pro quo, but we're at a stalemate unless Zelensky does everything Trump wants, which is basically the same as a quid pro quo. So this is only one witness, it's important to note, and in criminal proceedings or civil proceedings or court proceedings of any kind, we have witness conflicts all the time, and you have to choose which one to believe. This seems to set up a very direct conflict between the testimony of Sondland and Taylor, and the decision makers, the members of Congress who are voting on impeachment, and potentially eventually the senators who are voting on the impeachment trial will have to decide which of them they believe.
So I guess there are a couple of considerations when deciding who is more credible here. One is that Taylor's accounts of these conversations are based on contemporaneous notes, which points toward the idea that you would have less concern that he's misremembering or forgetting what happened because he wrote it down at the time. You would still have questions of credibility. You know, could Taylor be making all of this up? Now, it's not obvious what his motive would be to do that. He's a career diplomat. He has served in high positions in Ukraine and other places under both Republican and Democratic administrations. He was chosen to replace the ambassador that the president hated. So it's not like this is some person that he inherited from Barack Obama. This was indirectly his own personnel choice. And then also Sondland is a political associate of the president's who has an incentive to lie here if he did what Taylor said that he did, because it would be incriminating in a number of ways.
Absolutely. And let's face it, Sondland paid $1 million to Trump's inaugural to get the position he got. And, you know, he still wants to get his money's worth. But Taylor is a longtime public servant. Of course, that's more or less being used against him by the Trump administration. He's being portrayed as a longtime deep state person. and his work on both sides of the aisle for Republicans and Democrats as a public servant is being treated as suspicious rather than admirable. So this is very much the continuing narrative that the longtime unelected bureaucrats are out to get Trump.
It's funny. I mean, the obvious question there is then why the hell did they send Bill Taylor to Ukraine? Again, this was their own choice. They recalled the ambassador and then sent Taylor there to replace her. And I think the answer, other than they thought Taylor was a good guy, is that it goes to the incompetence of the Trump administration, the president's failure to appoint people to Senate-confirmed positions. It leaves him without an appropriate cadre of political appointees to send places. And so he is, ironically, as he whines and moans about the deep state, he is more reliant than most presidents on career staff because he just doesn't have the political appointees and confirmed officials around to send.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I also think he's just demonstrably not the great picker of people that he brags about being. I mean, the guy chose Giuliani and Michael Cohen as attorneys. So it's possible also he simply doesn't understand completely the concept of a nonpartisan, longtime dedicated public servant. He can't really grasp somebody not being on the make, and he assumes that if there's someone who will accept a political appointment, an ambassadorship or something like that, then they must be on my side. They must be my guy.
But the funny thing here is the president clearly understood that he needed, or for his whatever purposes he had, he needed an informal diplomatic channel. He needed to deputize Rudy Giuliani to go pressure the Ukrainians to do these things he wanted for political purposes. He used Gordon Sondland, who is an official in the State Department, but not one that you would normally think would be in the chain of command on Ukraine. He's the ambassador to the European Union. Ukraine is not a member of the European Union. And yet, in the process of managing this formal channel, for whatever reason, they brought Bill Taylor into the circle of management of that. And so they had this career civil servant there on these text message exchanges, party to these conversations, who then is able to go before Congress and tell everyone what they were up to.
Well, sure. But I mean, practically speaking, you need somebody who somewhat knows what they're doing. It's hard to carry out a complete black bag job with nobody who knows any of the channels. To have an outside channel, you need to know where the inside channel is. And I think they needed Taylor to some extent for that, to understand, who the players were and how to approach them.
So there are a number of other witnesses that Congress presumably will want to hear from where you have this disconnect between what Gordon Sondland claims was said and what Bill Taylor claims was said. In a lot of cases, there were other parties in these conversations. I mean, for example, there's Tim Morrison, who's this National Security Council official who replaced Fiona Hill. We had Fiona Hill's testimony a few days ago. She's an expert on Russia and the surrounding region. And so he is the one, Tim Morrison is the one who told Bill Taylor that Gordon Sondland had delivered this quid pro quo message from Ukraine. Presumably, they'd like to hear from Tim Morrison. Tim Morrison is, as far as I understand, a current White House official, so it might be more difficult to haul him before the committee. And then also, I don't think they've heard yet from John Bolton. And so much of this stuff surrounds John Bolton. John Bolton said that, he's not going to be a part of whatever drug deal that Gordon Sondland and Mick Mulvaney were cooking up. You would think that those are a couple of people that Congress would like to hear from.
Absolutely. And Bill Taylor said that Bolton was one of the ones trying to get Trump to release the Ukraine aid and not to pursue this course of a quid pro quo. So, some people have been speculating that Bolton is a whistleblower, one of the whistleblowers, and it certainly would be interesting to hear what he has to say. People have seen him as someone who is somewhat prideful and would not have liked the way he left the administration and maybe having some things to say.
Matt Whitaker, who was briefly the acting attorney general, appeared on Fox News as a pro-Trump talking head this week. And he offered a defense that I think is a preview of something we're going to be hearing more and more from Republicans in Congress. His literal phrase was, abuse of power is not a crime. And so if you admit that the president did the things that Bill Taylor accuses him of doing, I guess one thing you can say is sort of, so what? First of all, is he right? Is abuse of power not a crime?
Well, there's no federal criminal law called abuse of power. But as we've discussed many times, impeachment does not require a federal crime. Impeachment requires a high crime or misdemeanor, which means more or less what Congress makes it to mean. But I don't think there can be any historically credible argument whatsoever that the framers did not contemplate that abuses of the president's power could not be impeachable. It's very clear from the Federalist Papers, from the discussions surrounding the Constitution, all of that, that things like this were very much in the wheelhouse of what they contemplated that impeachment would be for. And so do all of our past impeachments.
So one thing we've been hearing from members of the House, actually on both sides of the aisle, is that they would like to hear Gordon Sondland testify again, try to clear up some of these discrepancies between his claims and Bill Taylor's claims. You were saying last week that you thought that Gordon Sondland's choice to testify was probably a good PR move, that he needed to try to establish that he wasn't the bad guy here to protect his reputation, protect business at the hotels that he owns in the Pacific Northwest. Do you still feel that that was a good idea now that we know what Bill Taylor has said? Does he face risk that he could face perjury charges if he misled Congress? And also, hasn't Bill Taylor's testimony made Gordon Sondland's choice to testify an ineffective PR strategy? Even if he does not end up putting himself in legal jeopardy, I don't know that this leaves Gordon Sondland looking any better than if Gordon Sondland hadn't spoken at all.
Well, you know, when I said that about Sondland, I was contemplating him telling the truth or at least not saying anything that could be easily disproven. In retrospect, that was probably not the brightest assumption to make because, I mean, I know what clients are like, and Sondland is the classic guy who needs some work before he can go in and really come clean and tell the whole truth. So, no, to the extent he went in and said things that were not true and were easily disproven by other people, then that's not a good PR move, and it's certainly legally risky in the sense that some people have said that he could be subject to charges for lying to Congress. So, but again, he is who he is. He's a guy who donated a vast amount of money to get a political position. He's not used to these waters. Would have been smarter to tell the whole truth and try to minimize that way. But to the extent he's lied and there are now people who can show that he's lied, it was definitely a very bad move.
Ken, did you know that conservative radio talk show host Hugh Hewitt is an attorney?
I knew that he was technically one.
He was a law professor, in fact.
Okay, well...
So Hugh Hewitt says basically that we have all of this wrong, and that in particular, the way people are, you know, interpreting Bill Taylor's testimony and saying that you have to understand it as damning toward the president, that we don't have enough room for differing opinions there. And in fact, the way people get angry when anyone suggests that Bill Taylor's testimony is anything other than damning for the president, that is an admission against interest on the part of the president's critics. Because if they felt confident in their case that the president had committed an impeachable offense, they would just be able to say so and calmly lay out the case and convince people rather than having to get angry when anybody disagrees with them. And so I guess, first of all, what is an admission against interest?
Not that. an admission against interest is a hearsay exception. So remember, hearsay is an out-of-court statement offered in court to prove the truth of it. And one exception to the hearsay rule is that when someone incriminates themselves in a way that they normally would not do, that's assumed to be admissible, reliable enough to be admissible hearsay. So take, for instance, if you want to offer testimony that Rudy Giuliani admitted to crimes on TV, well, that would generally be an admission against interest by Rudy Giuliani, so it might invoke that hearsay exception. What he seems to be using it is a very generic term for this person's reaction reveals something, which is not what it means. And he seems to be suggesting that because people are angry that Trump supporters continue to support him no matter what, that shows that they don't have a strong argument. I don't think that's particularly convincing. I mean, am I angry that some of the nation's lawyers and law professors and previously respected thinkers are willing to say or do anything and accept any argument in defense of the president? Honestly, Josh, I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed.
So then that's not an admission against interest because you're not angry.
No.
I mean, I saw someone on Twitter pointing out that this is like saying if somebody denies the Holocaust and then somebody else gets angry about their denial of the Holocaust and you say, aha, your anger shows that you are not confident that the Holocaust actually happened. If you knew that the Holocaust happened, you wouldn't be angry. You would just calmly explain to me that the Holocaust happened. That therefore is an admission against interest and lends credibility to Holocaust denial.
Well, sure. Hewitt's argument is just basically a snotty version of the troll argument. I'm getting under your skin. I must have a point.
Right. So, but I think that this, you know, I only take this detour about Hugh Hewitt to show the quality of the arguments in response to the evidence that we've had in favor of the president's wrongdoing. I mean, originally it was, you know, well, the whistleblower, all the information is secondhand and he was politically motivated and blah, blah, blah. And as we've gotten more and more firsthand testimony about this, those arguments are having to fall away, and instead it's, you know, like, neener, neener, look how angry you are kind of stuff.
Well, sure. It's the so what of Mulvaney's rather ill-considered press conference last week.
Let's talk about the counter-investigation, which is to say Bill Barr is overseeing some sort of probe in the Department of Justice looking into the origins of the investigation into Donald Trump's campaign in 2016. And officially, this investigation is actually being run by John Durham, who is the U.S. Attorney for the District of Connecticut. But Bill Barr has been heavily personally involved. He even traveled to Italy to speak with Italian officials about the possible involvement of Italian intelligence in this. There have been requests to Australia and various other countries. What is the nature of this probe? Is this a criminal investigation?
Well, that's the real question, and nobody seems to know for sure. It's criminal in the sense that it's being conducted by, the U.S. attorney for Connecticut. The office there has the power to bring criminal charges. Some of the things they're asserting or contemplating could potentially be federal crimes, but it's not really clear what the scope of it is. I can't emphasize enough how bizarre it is for the Attorney General of the United States himself to be flying around the world personally conducting interviews and inquiries as part of an investigation. That just doesn't happen. It would be weird enough for John Durham to be personally involved instead of involved on just a supervisory level. And it's also not clear exactly what the scope of this is, because we have so many theories floating around in Trump land about what went wrong. You have the theory that he was illegally surveilled during his campaign, the theory that there was a conspiracy to investigate him in which classified information was used improperly or lies were told to FISA courts. And then you've got the even more out there allegations like the whole DNC hack was a frame up that was a safety measure in case he won so that they could take him down, and that the server was actually in Ukraine. So it's a wide variety of crazy stuff it could be. But it really at this point seems that whether or not there's any there, that it really is being used as a political tool by the Attorney General and the administration. It's a little clever in a way, because one of Trump's main complaints for years now has been that these investigations are political. And everyone's response has been, no, this is the way it works. You do investigations, you gather information, you make determinations. And so now it's very hard to fight back against an investigation that the administration is doing. It's hard to turn around and suddenly say, no, investigations aren't legitimate. So that's a little bit clever on their part.
But so what sort of end product could we expect from an investigation like this? Because, I mean, I guess if it's a criminal investigation, they could be trying to find people to indict. But NBC News reports on the status of this investigation and says that they haven't even interviewed a lot of the key witnesses that you would need to talk to in a probe like this. Like, they haven't talked to Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, the former general counsel of the FBI, James Baker. Could they just be trying to put together some sort of report that the president could point to and say, look at all this wrongdoing of me? But again, that seems weird if it's a criminal investigation, because isn't that what James Comey got in trouble for? That, like, if you have a criminal investigation and it does not lead to charges, you're not supposed to say anything about what you found. This is not an inspector general report. So what would we get out of this?
Well, it's not clear. And there is an inspector general investigation, and this is being done separately from that. So we don't know whether it's going to be producing some sort of you know, basically propaganda piece, some sort of a report that they can use in the news for the election, or whether they really are seeking criminal charges. And I would point out that the fact that they haven't interviewed key people does not necessarily mean that they're not taking a criminal approach, because they could be seeking to indict those people. And in general, you don't interview the people you're seeking to indict, at least until the very, very end of the investigation. So they could be doing almost anything. It would be pretty much speculation at this point to say.
Where would they have to bring charges if they ended up doing so? Because I'm wondering if you could end up in a similar situation that they seem to have ended up in with Andrew McCabe, who there were these reports that the U.S. attorney for the District of the District of Columbia was going to bring charges against him for lying to federal investigators, the same things that were cited for terminating his employment at the FBI. And we have at least circumstantial evidence that suggests that they tried to get a grand jury to indict him, and the grand jury very unusually refused to do so. Would you similarly have to get indicted in a case like this through a heavily, you know, a grand jury in the District of Columbia that might be very unsympathetic to the president?
Sooner or later, you would. I mean, you'd either have to bring a complaint, which means getting a federal magistrate judge to sign off that there's probable cause based on an affidavit, or you'd have to present it to a grand jury who could very much be skeptical of it. It's not 100% clear it would have to be D.C. That would seem to be the natural venue for it. But if some of the acts involved also occurred in other places, then there's some wiggle room for creativity about where to venue it. You see that in some big investigation sometime when there's a power struggle over where to make the home base, and based on sometimes a somewhat tenuous connection of the crime to that place. So D.C. is the most likely place, but the Trump administration is so skeptical of D.C. to begin with that they may try to bring it someplace else.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk about Rudy Giuliani. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Let's talk about Rudy Giuliani and two sort of odd news stories we've gotten this week about Rudy Giuliani. The first is from the New York Times over the weekend, and it's about the Justice Department putting out an odd statement distancing itself from the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. The Times reports that the Justice Department issued a statement saying that department officials would not have met with Mr. Giuliani to discuss one of his clients if they had known that federal prosecutors in New York were investigating two of Giuliani's associates. Several weeks ago, apparently, there was a meeting between Brian Benskowski, who runs the criminal division of the Justice Department, and other lawyers from the fraud section of the Justice Department. They met with Giuliani to discuss what the Times describes as a bribery case, where Giuliani, along with other attorneys, were representing the defendants. It's kind of weird that they felt the need to make a public statement about this, right?
It is weird, and the language they used is very striking. They were not portraying Giuliani as the lawyer for these guys, and he wasn't, but as their associate.
To be clear, the lawyer for Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. Giuliani
exactly.
Was the lawyer for whatever fraud, whatever bribery defendant the meeting was about.
Right. They described him as Fruman and Parnas's associate. So more or less, they were what this conveys to me is they're saying that we would not have met with someone who may or may not be entangled in a crime that we are investigating if we had realized that's who he was. It's very much a concession that there's an appearance of impropriety in letting somebody who may be entangled in one of your investigations into DOJ to have a talk about another investigation. And it's somewhat rueful on the part of Department of Justice. And it is very much not a pro-Trump administration message. And it may reflect, to some extent, the ongoing conflict between the career prosecutors, the career Department of Justice attorneys, and the Trump appointees and the people seeking Trump's agenda.
Although the statement came from a DOJ spokesman, Peter Carr, so it came from – it's not like this was a statement issued from some U.S. attorney's office where people were annoyed. This came from Maine Justice.
Sure, but it's not something that you would expect Bill Barr, for instance, to originate, because it's very unflattering for Giuliani. It has – sort of negative implications for Giuliani's role in the indictment in New York, and definitely reflects a level of judgment about Giuliani that is not flattering, and not flattering to the president.
But I don't know that I wouldn't describe that to Barr, because this isn't the first time that we've had statements from Barr distancing himself from whatever Rudy Giuliani was up to, saying that they, you know, there have been previous Justice Department statements saying that they don't know what Giuliani was referring to in terms of Bill Barr's involvement in certain conversations about Ukraine.
Well, sure. It could be part of a bus throwing of Rudy, which is anticipated and to some extent has happened when you saw the president saying he wasn't sure whether Rudy was still his lawyer. So that could be an explanation as well.
I read this story, and then I read a story on Tuesday from the Washington Post that introduces a new character to this saga, a Ukrainian oligarch named Dmytro Firtash, who's in the energy business. And since 2013, he's been facing American charges for committing bribery in India. And we've been trying to extradite him. He lives in Vienna, and 6 years on, we have not yet succeeded in extraditing him, although at one point we got an order from an Austrian court ordering his extradition. This guy, Firtash, seems to have significant ties to Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. The three of them were working together on some liquid natural gas deal, it appears. Parnas and Fruman were pressuring the Ukrainian state gas company to forego some financial claims they had against this oligarch, Firtash. Firtash also has new lawyers in this long-standing bribery case that he's trying to avoid trial for in the United States. Firtash used to be represented by Lanny Davis, who's a highly connected Democratic lawyer with lots of sleazy clients around the world. But this summer, he replaced Davis with Victoria Tonsing and Joseph DeGeneva, who are these MAGA orbit Republican lawyers who've been associated with Rudy Giuliani. Now, Giuliani, for his part, says that he doesn't know Dmytro Firtash, but he's been waving around on television an affidavit from a former Ukrainian prosecutor saying that he was fired because he was trying to investigate the Bidens. And this affidavit was obtained by Firtash's lawyers as part of their effort to stop his extradition to the United States. And it seemed they had some success with that, or at least they've gotten more time tying up the case in the Austrian courts without him being extradited to the U.S. I would finally note that when Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman were arrested a few weeks ago, they were at Washington Dulles Airport and they were trying to get on a flight to go to Vienna. And Rudy Giuliani had also been scheduled to go to Vienna the following day, which, you know, at least just happens to be where Dmytro Firtash lives. Do you read anything into all of this?
Coincidence, Josh. Mere coincidence. Have you not had the pastries of Vienna? Have you not seen the streets in the fall?
Vienna does have fine pastries and classical music.
Yes. So, well, yes, it certainly looks suspicious. And you know, you've raised, and I think not unreasonably, whether or not the meetings with Department of Justice at which Rudy Giuliani attended might have been about this same case, which would have been an even closer connection and even more of a reason for Department of Justice to be upset once they figured out Giuliani's connections to all the players here. So they do certainly seem to be interconnected. And aside from slightly dissenting from your characterization as of sleazy clients all over the world, the correct term is misunderstood clients throughout the global community. It does seem like there are some real connections here between the Austrian extradition attempt and then now this new federal case in New York. And we don't really know and won't know for a while because Firtash has not been extradited. So the case doesn't really proceed against him and we don't really find out anything about it until he gets here.
One other detail in this Washington Post story has to do with some things that Parnas and Fruman said at some energy conference in Texas last year to some people associated with the Ukrainian National Gas Company. They mentioned that they'd been hoping to get Marie Yovanovitch, the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, removed because they thought she was standing in the way of this gas deal that they wanted to make in Ukraine. So, I mean, I think that's interesting that Parnas and Fruman had this apparent business interest related to this indicted oligarch, and they had business reasons to want the U.S. ambassador removed in Ukraine at the same time that Giuliani was working energetically to try to get the ambassador removed, eventually successfully.
And it's strange because the narrative in the New York case would more seem to be that they were supporting Giuliani's efforts, which had to do with the ambassador being an impediment to the attempt to shake down Ukraine for announcing an investigation of Biden's son. So maybe there were multiple reasons and maybe there were multiple agendas going on at the same time.
I want to go back again to something I said last week about Tim Cook. This line that if you're not paying, you're not the customer, you're the product. Giuliani holds himself out as the president's attorney, talks about himself going around the world advocating for the president's interests. This seems like more of an indication that Giuliani was using his influence within the administration toward the interests of other associates of his rather than necessarily toward the president's own interests.
It certainly does seem that he had dual loyalties that were somewhat troubling at the time. Now, you might represent someone like the president without pay because he's the president. It's extremely prestigious, at least within certain circles, and it gives you a lot of credibility. But here, it certainly seems as if Giuliani's access to the president, his ability to help shape his agenda and suggest how to carry it out, were also coincidentally extremely beneficial to some of his own private clients who were paying him large amounts of money.
Let's talk about Roger Stone. Roger Stone, the self-described dirty trickster Republican operative in the president's orbit, or at least historically in the president's orbit. His criminal trial for lying to federal investigators, which is what everyone gets criminally charged for, is supposed to start on November 5th. Listeners may remember that prosecutors in this case had told long-suffering federal judge Amy Berman Jackson that one of the things they wanted to do at Stone's trial was show the jury a clip from the film The Godfather Part II. That's because Stone had told his associate Randy Credico that he wanted Credico to do a Pantangeli when Credico would testify before Congress. That's a reference to Frank Pantangeli, who is a mob associate who lies to Congress in The Godfather Part II. And so they wanted to show the clip so that the jury would understand what it meant to do a Pantangeli. But I guess Jackson ruled against prosecutors, saying they can't show the clip, they can only use a transcript of the scene.
That's right. Judge Amy Berman Jackson, who certainly has over the last 2 years appeared on this show quite a bit and suffered more than her share of this administration's legal entanglements, had to do something that's very typical of judges. She had to make a balancing decision between how prejudicial versus probative evidence is. This is a test that happens all the time in criminal and civil cases, in state and federal court. And basically the question is this piece of evidence more probative of something legitimate than it is unfairly prejudicial and inflammatory? And she made a very straightforward call that, you know, being part of The Godfather Part II, being about the mob, but having all this extraneous stuff about mob business was more prejudicial than it was probative because the prosecutors could explain what the Godfather reference meant without playing the full clip.
Stone also remains subject to a gag order that keeps him off social media. He had asked an appellate court to free him and let him talk as he wished, and the appellate court said no.
That's right. He and his family members who felt that they were also constrained by that gag order. Recall that Stone was doing a lot of crazy things online, including but not limited to showing a picture of Amy Berman Jackson with what may have been crosshairs next to her. She did not react well, and she used the terms of his bond condition as a way to gag him, basically requiring him to stop venting about the case online as a condition of his bail and requiring that his family not do it on his behalf. He and his family sought what's called a writ of mandamus from the D.C. Circuit. A writ of mandamus is different than an appeal. An appeal is a routine by the rules, by the schedule request to an appellate court to overturn a lower court. And a request for a writ of mandamus is an emergency appeal, in effect. It's for extraordinary circumstances where, for whatever reason, a normal appeal wouldn't work. And what the D.C. Circuit said was that this is not an emergency and there are other avenues.
Your use of Instagram is not an emergency.
Well, not so much that, but you could have appealed this. There is a procedure to appeal bail conditions with deadlines. You missed those deadlines. You did not use that procedure. Your family, if they felt constrained by the terms, they could have also appealed as third parties withstanding because they're affected by the order. They didn't do so either. And because you didn't use these rules available to you, this is not an extraordinary circumstance where you have no relief. So go away. So it was a procedural discussion, but not one that was particularly sympathetic to the substance of Stone's argument either.
The president, meanwhile, has been threatening to sue CNN. His attorney, Charles Harder, sent a threat letter to CNN saying that they were going to sue and asking for CNN to pay damages. And this is related to James O'Keefe, the conservative activist, obtaining some leaked internal conversations at CNN. And based on what's in those conversations, the president says that the network is falsely claiming to be fair when they're not fair. And that's a violation of the Lanham Act. And that's why the president gets to sue them. What is the Lanham Act?
So the Lanham Act is a federal law that governs advertising and unfair competition. It does not govern how a TV network talks about you. So Harder's letter is widely viewed as being ridiculous bluster, which frankly is what you expect from Mr. Harder, who's kind of the go-to guy if you're really rich and you think that means you have a right not to be criticized and you want someone to write nasty threatening letters for you with no legal merit. So it's not an Lanham Act violation for CNN to say that they're good journalists and fair journalists and responsible journalists, even if they're not. Because it's not a Lanham Act violation against Trump, because the Lanham Act only applies to competitors. It does not apply to consumers. So if Trump opened up his own network and CNN were trash-talking it or making exaggerated claims about how CNN's better than Trump's network, that could be a Lanham Act violation against Trump's network. There would be a number of defenses, like, you know, it was just puffery and not factual claims, but that could be something. However, this is absolutely not a thing. You can't sue the media for a Lanham Act violation because you don't like their coverage.
To be clear, for it to be a Lanham Act violation, it has to be a factual claim. So, like, if you say we're the best news network, that's an opinion, right? And so that, you know, that couldn't be unfair competition.
Sure. And a lot of Lanham Act litigation is over the margins between fact and opinion, or puffery and, you know, real statements of fact, and what is understood by the public to be sincere and literal and what is not. So, you know, it's like Fox News calls itself fair and balanced. I think likely in any Lanham Act case that CNN brought against Fox News, not that they'd be stupid enough to do that, a court would likely say that that's not any sort of literal claim. It's a slogan and puffery and that type of thing.
There is much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to leave it. Ken White, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
We will have another Left, Right, and Center episode for you on Friday. There's a lot to talk about this week. I have yet another thing to ask Rich Lowry about whether we finally reached his threshold for impeachable offenses. To get that episode, make sure you're subscribed to Left, Right, and Center on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. And if you have a question about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave voicemail at 310-853-3514. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week for more All the President's Lawyers.